Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. I'm Livonia Mallory, and I'm still on my couch.
And I'm Guy Schaefer, coming from my bedroom. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, first, Elizabeth Press speaks with Zach Ahmad and Melanie Trimble from the New York Civil Liberties Union about Rensselaer County's decision to renew its 287G contract with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Then on Reclaiming History, Livonia Mallory and Guy Schaefer speak with Joseph Jenkins, author of the Humanoir Handbook. After that, Alexis Goldsmith speaks with Emma Willard student Sujin Chung about her interest in permaculture. Then on Upstate Housing, Michelle Masurgeon speaks with New York State Assembly candidate Sam Fine about housing justice issues in the Albany area. And to close out the show, Spencer Keeble speaks with Lex Begat about the Albany Free Schools Bucket Garden Program. But first, here are the headlines.
Capital area hospitals say that Governor Cuomo's revised directive prohibiting the discharge of seniors with positive COVID-19 tests back into nursing homes are filling up hospital beds and causing financial problems. The hospitals have already lost revenues because of a decline in elective surgeries. Patients are also staying away from emergency rooms, a major source of revenues for the hospitals.
The Times Union reports that all of the Troy School District's 23 reading teachers have been cut from its proposed $113.65 million budget for the 2020 to 2021 school year, which will be approved by absentee ballot on June 9th. A last-minute petition bearing more than 700 signatures asking the school board not to eliminate the reading teachers failed to prevent the Board of Education from adopting these austerity measures. The budget includes a 2% tax increase.
A Daily Gazette reports that plans to renovate the McDonald's at the corner of Upper Union and Dean Street in Schenectady have been tabled following community opposition at the recent public hearing. The proposal had sought to demolish two existing structures and replace them with a 4,350-square-foot McDonald's.
Following criticism by the Schenectady NAACP and spiritual leaders over the county's sluggish response to addressing racial disparities and the impacts of coronavirus, County Manager Rory Fluman has pledged to step up efforts to communicate. The Gazette noted that statewide and in Schenectady, the virus has ravaged minority residents in economically distressed neighborhoods. Schenectady County came under fire by the Schenectady NAACP and clergy against hate last week for being slow to address how racial disparities are manifesting themselves in a city that's both more racially diverse and poorer than its regional counterparts.
The Capital Region suffered an alarming number of drug overdose in a 14-hour period from Wednesday night into Thursday morning, caused by cocaine that was tainted with fentanyl. There were 30 overdoses involving the lethal concoction, including two fatalities. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. And I'm Livonia Mallory, and I'm still on my couch.
And I'm Guy Schaefer, still broadcasting from my apartment. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, send an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. That's hmm@mediasanctuary.org. This past week, Rensselaer County renewed its contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, under the 287G agreement. WOOC correspondent Elizabeth Press spoke to Zach Ahmad and Melanie Trimble from the New York Civil Liberties Union about what this means.
Today we are talking about 287G with policy counselor for the New York Civil Liberties Union, Zach Ahmad, and Melanie Trimble, the New York Civil Liberties Union Capital Region Chapter Director. Thank you both for joining us on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine today.
Thank you for having us.
In general terms, what is 287G?
Sure. So the 287G program is a federal program created under federal immigration law. So it's a formal program that puts correction officers under the supervision of ICE supervisors and has them performing a number of immigration-related tasks, which could include issuing immigration detainers, which are pieces of paper asking that a person be held, detaining people for civil immigration purposes, inquiring and investigating people's immigration statuses who come into local jails, and transporting people on behalf of ICE. It essentially makes local officers de facto ICE agents and puts them under the control of ICE for certain purposes. Generally, local authorities do not have the authority to enforce immigration law absent the cooperation and direction of ICE. 287G is a program that allows them to do that.
Zach Ahmed, can you go into this a little bit further? Like, how did local law enforcement and ICE start these programs in collaboration?
The 287G program was created by federal law in 1996. ICE only has so many resources, and so it is beneficial to them when they can have the assistance of local authorities investigating immigration offenses and assisting them with immigration enforcement. We do not think that is the proper role of local authorities. The role of local authorities should be to serve their communities and enforce local laws and protect community well-being.
Here in Rensselaer County, we are the only county in New York State that participates in this 287G contract. Sheriff Russo just renewed this 287G contract. Melanie Trimble, could you talk about how specifically 287G affects us here in Rensselaer County?
Well, that's a very good question because we have found out very little information from the sheriff about its use. We don't know how many people have been captured by the program. We don't know how many officers are participating in the program. We don't know how much money the county is spending to participate in the agreement. All of this information was requested of the sheriff in a letter that we sent a few weeks ago. The sheriff acknowledged receipt of the letter, but never responded to the concerns that we had, despite our asking in several forms for a meeting. It's a little disconcerting to have a county official not answering questions that are coming from their constituents, and we certainly would welcome a conversation about how it's being used at the jail.
And Melanie Trimble, on behalf of the New York Civil Liberties Union, you had an opinion piece published in the Times Union this week ahead of the renewal. Is this in response for not getting a response from your direct communication with the sheriff's office?
Yes. We wanted to make it public that we have asked the sheriff for these specific questions about the program, and he has refused to answer. There are several community groups that are interested in having a conversation with the sheriff, and we hope to address that. Part of the agreement states that the sheriff will hold a public meeting to discuss the program with. That happened once, but it was not really a conversation. It was a PowerPoint presentation. And we would like to have a more thorough and robust conversation with the sheriff over the program.
One thing that stood out to me from your op-ed was a statement that said most law enforcement agencies recognize the 287G contract undermine public safety. I was wondering if you could speak to that.
As much as the sheriff assures us that it's only a correctional officer or two and that their jurisdiction will only be in the jail, it sends a chilling effect out into the community that there are some law enforcement individuals that are enforcing local law enforcement of immigration law, and it makes anybody, not even just people that are not documented, we're talking about anybody who looks a little different or sounds a little different, you know, is very afraid to interface with law enforcement because of the fact that they may be captured and held and maybe even shipped off to Batavia. And the mistakes have been made, particularly in Rensselaer County. And so we're very concerned. We do believe that having law enforcement participate in any capacity in a 287G agreement causes a lot of discomfort within the communities and discourages cooperation with law enforcement. It makes police officers' jobs more difficult to have people hide from them and not want to engage during investigations or even calling for emergency services.
How is community involvement and other 287G contracts, is there a usual way that that is supposed to play out?
Community outreach is something that is embedded into every 287G agreement. There are provisions that require jurisdictions to hold steering committee meetings and to engage in other community outreach as appropriate. And this has been an area of critique over the 287G program. New York is not the only place where there's a lack of transparency. And in fact, the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General has specifically criticized the 287G program in the past for its lack of transparency and the failure to use the steering committee process to meaningfully engage members of the community. And that's something that at minimum needs to change. Certainly, we think the sheriff's office, which can sever the 287G agreement at any time, even though it was just renewed, what we want is for Rensselaer County to not engage in 287G and to withdraw from the contract. But while they're doing so, at the very least, they have to be engaging the community more meaningfully, holding regular meetings, allowing stakeholders to not just be present in the audience at a public meeting, but to actually have a seat at the table and share information and help shape how the 287G program is operating, if it needs to operate at all, which of course we do not think it does.
In the 2 years since Sheriff Russo made this deal with ICE, it seems like there's not a lot of information. Public safety, you're saying, is a concern, especially for immigrant families. And it also has been said that there's drain on local resources. Could you speak to that last point? Who pays for 287G?
That is one of the pieces where we'd like there to be more transparency because there is some mixed information. But what's important to note is that counties do not get paid to participate in the 287G program. This is not something that is in any way some kind of revenue raiser for the county. There are certain costs associated with attending trainings. There are certain equipment upgrades that are required in order to install the software that ICE needs to use to effectuate immigration enforcement at the local level. But I think what's important to note is that when we're talking about resources, we're not just talking about literal dollars and cents that are cost to the county. We're talking about the way in which the county's attention and the sheriff's office's attention is diverted from other matters. When they are deciding voluntarily to engage in this program that no other law enforcement agency in the state is engaging in, to deputize their officers to perform immigration law, they are necessarily taking those officers' attention away from what should be their core duties and having them focus on immigration law instead. And immigration law is something that's very complex. That is why there's certain training required under 287G, but really the minimal training that's required under the program is not sufficient to learn immigration law. And so there's also a possibility of mistakes being made and exposed risk for the county as a result of that.
Thanks for explaining that, Zach. Now, Zach Ahmed or Melanie Trimble, is there anything else that you want to make sure that we cover here today?
Well, we just want to remind people, too, that just because he signed the agreement doesn't mean that we can't continue to call for backing out of it. Stay tuned. We're certainly going to do the best that we can to try and get the information out of the sheriff's office and get that information out to the public.
I would just say that what we've talked about already in terms of the community trust that is necessary for local officers to do their jobs and that's undermined by 287G is especially critical in the current moment because we are living in a moment in which the government is providing a number of services to the public for public health purposes, things like testing for COVID-19, contact tracing, other services that are going to be necessary to fight the coronavirus pandemic, and that it's especially important that all members of the community feel comfortable interacting with the government in order for those efforts to be effective. And so when you have something like 287G in place, it sends a message that that unfortunately causes a level of distrust, which is particularly harmful in the current environment. So I just want to elevate that.
That was the New York Civil Liberties Union Policy Council, Zach Ahmed, and Melanie Trimble of the New York Civil Liberties Union Capital Region Chapter Director, speaking with Elizabeth Press. For more information on how to get involved with the Capital Region Chapter, call 518-436-8594.
Up next, it is our pleasure to welcome to the show Joseph Jenkins, author of The Human War Handbook, and I'm actually forgetting the subtitle on that. Are you there, Joseph?
I am, and you don't want to say the subtitle.
We'll get in trouble for it. So The Human War Handbook. So The Human War Handbook, for those of you who are not familiar, is the preeminent resource on composting human waste. Widely cited, widely translated, hugely influential in the world of composting. Mr. Jenkins, before we get started, I just want to say that I was so excited when Livonia told me that she was reaching out to you. I'm a huge compost fan, and I've been super curious about humanure for a while, even though I've only barely been involved in that. So thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, great. A fellow composter. That's that's nice to hear.
Yeah, big time. Yeah, we can catch up more. First off, can you tell us, let's kind of start big picture. Can you start off just by telling us what humanure is?
Humanure is human manure. It's a term that I coined because all the other words for that substance, you can't say them on some of them on the radio, for example. And you can't really discuss the topic very easily at dinner with grandma using the old terminology. So humanure is an innocuous term, meaning human manure, or what people, human bodies, excrete as a result of their digestive systems. So it's human excrement and human urine. And recycled for constructively recycled for agricultural purposes. That separates the concept from human waste. Human waste is, a cigarette butt you fling out your car window. That's human waste, but people generally refer to human waste as human excrement, which is wasted. And when it's wasted, of course, it is waste. But humanure is not wasted. It's completely recycled. Nothing is wasted. When you use a compost toilet system, so therefore a new term had to be coined, and that's where humanure comes from.
Right. Yeah, as we say in the compost world, waste is a verb. So in the humanure handbook, you make a beautiful call for the wider adoption of thinking about it as humanure and finding better ways to recycle it. Can you tell us a little bit about how the world would be improved, how the world would be different if people composted humanure instead of using flush toilets?
Well, right off the bat, there are 2.5 billion with a B people who don't have toilets. Mm-hmm. So right off the bat, 2.5 billion people could have toilets if they knew that they could have a compost toilet. I've been to 64 countries so far, many of them multiple times. And one of the most startling things about teaching people how to make a compost toilet is that they say they never would ever have dreamed that such a thing existed. They never heard of it. And I've been doing it for 43 years, so it's second nature to me. But if when I'm in, say, for example, in Nicaragua, in a village where everybody open defecates, and we show them how to make a compost toilet, so the toilet's inside their dwelling, and they're taught, we train them the whole process, and they're just flabbergasted that they can actually have a toilet that doesn't smell, doesn't pollute, doesn't need electricity, doesn't need water, and they can have it right beside their bed where they sleep, as opposed to having to wander out into a field or outside in the dark or in the rain to answer the call of nature. So that right off the bat, that would be a huge change in the world. Now, if you want me to elaborate and be more specific, when humanure is recycled, a whole lot of water pollution is prevented. Mm-hmm. Every time a toilet is flushed, actually every time a toilet is used, water is polluted. Now, water has to go someplace. Somebody has to deal with it. The effluent from wastewater treatment plants is still polluted, and there's nothing that you can do about it. It's just impossible to completely clean water that's been that's been used in a toilet. Secondly, there's a ton of soil fertility that goes down the drain mm-hmm. when a water toilet is used. And it is just going to waste. That's where the human waste comes from, the term. That soil fertility could all be recycled. So imagine if a dairy farmer with a herd of cattle flushed all the cattle manure down a drain. Other farmers would think he's nuts because they need that manure to fertilize the fields, to grow the food that the cattle eat. So we don't. We just flush ours, down the toilet, and it goes to waste, and we buy artificial fertilizers. So we could have greatly enhanced soil fertility, a lot less pollution, if humanure was recycled on a wider scale around the world. But more importantly right now, in my opinion, is people can have toilets who don't have them all. At all.
That is the way that you're framing it. Humanure seems like such an amazing game changer for so many people in so many different positions. So I'm really excited that you're doing this advocacy work.
I look at it as the last great untapped resource. As long
the
as
final
there's
frontier
people
of recycling.
Yeah, as long as there are people, there will be humanure. It has value, every time you use a compost toilet, it's like putting a nickel in a piggy bank. You're actually collecting something of value that will come back and reward you later because it turns into compost, and compost grows food. So, it's a pretty interesting concept. In general, though, around the world, most of the humanure, mountains of humanure, hundreds of thousands of millions of tons are all going to waste.
Going to waste and also polluting the water around the streams and the villages all over the world.
The rivers, lakes, estuaries, groundwater.
Exactly.
Right. So
my most recent edition of the Humanure Handbook, I dwell a lot more on those issues.
Right.
Water pollution. Because it's not just water. You're not just polluting water with humanure or human waste, let's call it, because it's being wasted. But everything that goes into your body that comes out again, like pharmaceuticals and drugs and antibiotics and chemo drugs. I mean, all that stuff comes out and gets into the water. It's incredible how much chemical and pharmaceutical effluents there are that people aren't even aware of.
So we've got about 30 seconds left, but I wanted to just see if you had any quick words of advice for people who are interested in trying to practice humanure composting in suburban homes or in cities.
Well, well, first thing I would say is get a copy of my book, The Humanure Handbook, and I'm not trying to sell it, because you can read it free online at humanurehandbook.com. You can read the entire thing cover to cover for free. It's been free online since 2000, for 20 years. And people can read it. And if they, you know, if they're interested enough, they'll buy a copy or buy or download a copy. You can download a copy as well. So get a hold of the book, Humanure Handbook. It's in the fourth edition now. And there's a ton of information in there that pertains to everybody.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, I think I would love to suggest maybe a Humanure Handbook reading group. If anyone is interested, just give us a call at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Happy to try to organize that.
Listen, Mr. Jenkins, thank you so much for joining us. He is author of Humanure Handbook. Thank you for sharing your expertise with us here at Hudson Mohawk Magazine. We really appreciate it so much.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Yeah, and that website again is humanurehandbook.com. That's H-U-M-A-N-U-R-E handbook.com.
Up next, Emma Willard student Sujin Chung will lead a virtual permaculture workshop and tour the Sanctuary for Independent Media from her home in South Korea. That's going to be taking place next week. In the upcoming interview, Sujin will be talking about how learning about permaculture at the Sanctuary for Independent Media has affected her life and what inspired this project. The event will take place Thursday, May 28th from 10 to 11:30 a.m. And you can register for it at tinyurl.com/HAC05282.
I'm speaking with Sujin Chung, who is an intern with the Sanctuary for Independent Media from Emma Willard. Welcome to the show, Sujin.
Thank you. I'm Sujin.
Could you tell us, you know, what you did as a sanctuary intern?
So I was first introduced to permaculture at the sanctuary. And through my project, I wanted to spread the idea of the permaculture to community members and the Emma Willard community. And my final project was to create a permaculture workshop where I would talk about permaculture and explore the existing permaculture in North Troy.
And what was your experience with permaculture, you know, before this, and how did you get introduced to it here at the sanctuary?
So when I first joined the Nature Lab as an intern, I didn't really know anything about permaculture, and even the word permaculture was unfamiliar to me. But one of my supervisors, Simone Johnson, gave me a list of projects that I could do at the sanctuary, and when I first looked at the list, permaculture stood out to me. And I did some research on the topic and realized that this topic could be perfect as my individual project for my STEAM program at my school. I also realized that the sanctuary was very involved in nature. So being introduced to the Colored City Growers Garden at the sanctuary, I thought that I could expand my interest in science and nature through my project on permaculture.
So can you talk about what you had planned for this project and the workshop?
Since I was younger, I was invested in protecting the ecosystem and the earth. And coming to Emma Willard, I realized that so many other people had the same beliefs as me. So I wanted to spread the word about permaculture and its principles because I thought that it was really important in my values and other people's values as well. So I thought that I could spread awareness about the existing permaculture in our community through my project. And also to convince others to join the cause of protecting our earth and preserving relationships. And I think that it's really important to implement permaculture into our lives. So I think that's why I started my project.
So the workshop initially had been planned to be an in-person permaculture tour of the sanctuary's campus, but can you tell our listeners where you are now?
I'm in South Korea, in Seoul right now.
And you had to go home because of the coronavirus, is that correct?
Yes.
And how does permaculture in your hometown, where when you look outside, how does it compare to what you saw in the United States?
So permaculture in South Korea is not as prevalent compared to America. And although I'm relying on my personal experiences, living in Seoul, a city with tall buildings and busy streets, I never got to really interact with nature. And I think that many South Koreans are not very involved in nature. But I think right now, South Korea is in its developing stage. And I think during my project, I tried to find organizations that were involved in permaculture, but I could only spot a few that were not very active currently. And I think that if I were to expand my project, I would probably educate people in South Korea as well as about permaculture and its importance in our ecosystem and our relationships. And I think because many people in South Korea live in busy cities, I think permaculture can be perfect in positively impacting their lives. Because when I go to the streets and stores, I see half-empty drinks and advertising flyers all over. But I think that if people get to know about permaculture, these acts can change.
So tell our listeners what they can expect at the... Let me rephrase. So you're still planning to go through with the workshop. Can you explain what it will be like now, how you've adjusted it?
So we were originally hoping to lead participants through Freedom Square, the College City Growers Garden, and the Elot directly through the permaculture walk. But because of the pandemic, we made changes to the format of the workshop. Although it is virtual, we tried to include as many parts where participants can engage. And also with the help of the sanctuary, we're now able to show live footage of the various places we are going to introduce. And I'm so excited to share my research on permaculture through this virtual workshop, because I know that it wouldn't have been possible without the sanctuary.
And what can listeners expect in the workshop?
I think in the workshop, we're going to show you different parts of permaculture that's existing in Freedom Square, College City Growers Garden, and the Elot. And I think people can carry on the principles of permaculture and maybe implement that into their lives as well. And for me, when I first learned about permaculture, it was really fascinating because it kind of changed my perspective on seeing the world. And many people may think that permaculture is only about gardening and the nature, but I think that permaculture is also about relationships between you and the people living around you as well. So I think that my workshop can kind of really show what permaculture is and how it can make an impact on people's lives.
And I'm just curious how you foresee yourself continuing to integrate this philosophy in your future from where you are.
I think that permaculture is really important in our daily lives because it kind of teaches you that small acts can make changes positively and negatively. And I think that realizing this is very important because whenever you make small acts, like maybe cleaning up the trash that you see in the sidewalk, that can make a huge change and that can bring others to do it as well. So I think that's what I'm going to try to do from now on, that I'm doing a project on permaculture.
And you also have a permaculture blog. Can you talk about that a bit?
I have a blog that records what I do weekly, and it shows who I am and what I'm trying to pursue through my project. And you can kind of see like the developing stage of my knowledge of permaculture and what I learned weekly, what I achieved weekly. And I think this blog kind of made me realize how much I learned through this program.
And is there a URL we can go to read more?
Yeah. If you visit the sanctuary website under People Power, if you see Sujin Chang, you can see in the description my personal website.
This has been Sanctuary intern Sujin Chang talking to us from South Korea. Thank you for joining us, Sujin.
Thank you for inviting me.
The Nature Lab Virtual Permaculture Walk will take place on Thursday, May 28th from 10 to 11:30 a.m. and it will be interactive. There's also going to be a discussion in addition to the tour, and we'll be throwing seed bombs, correct? So I'm really looking forward to it. I myself will be manning the camera, but this is all Sujin's project. So thank you again, Sujin.
Thank you.
That was our very own engineer and producer, Alexis Goldsmith, talking with Emma Willard student Sujin Chang about her permaculture workshop that's taking place on May 28th, 10 to 11:30. You can register at tinyurl.com/HACO5282.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm Livonia Mallory.
You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC LP 105.3 FM in Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM in Schenectady, WOOA LP 106.9 FM in Albany, and WCAA LP 107.3 FM in Albany, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Up next on Upstate Housing, Michelle Masurgeon speaks with Sam Fine, who is running for New York State 108th District Assembly seat. Sam discusses the current status of housing injustice issues in the Albany area.
Hello all. My guest today is Sam Fine, who's running for State Assembly against incumbent John T. McDonald. Welcome, Sam.
Thank you, Michelle.
And today we're kind of going to be talking about environmental justice issues, which kind of makes us look at where housing is situated, especially for low-income residents, and determining who's accountable for ensuring their safety and health, and what our local leaders can be doing right here in the Capital Region. So I'm gonna just start off with the Norlight facilities and the families living in the Saratoga apartments in Cohoes, and Assemblyman McDonald, who was a former mayor of Cohoes, kind of now on the bandwagon of what's going on with the problems at Norlight. But the folks living in Cohoes have known about these issues for years. What do you say about what's happening at Norlight and the folks living in Saratoga apartments?
You know, it just seems to me like it's too little being done too late. Oftentimes for a lot of our leaders, it takes a lot of pressure for anything like this for them to take action on things like this. And as you mentioned, John McDonald has been the mayor. He was the mayor of Cohoes for over 12 years. He's in the assembly for 8 years. So I would have liked to see action on this much sooner.
So I guess there's a lot to say for citizen action.
A lot of the times, that's what really spurs action being taken. If you look at Ezra Prentice Public Housing in the south end of Albany, there are a lot of community groups that came together. They had huge rallies down there. They residents who lived there got together with environmentalists and together, and that happened as well in Sheridan Hollow in Albany. And then it really got attention. At the same time, though, you need leaders who are going to partner with those groups and take the lead as well, not just respond once the pressure gets to be large enough.
So on the issue of Ezra Prentice, what's happening with them? Because I understand the Port of Albany is looking to expand and the city said you had to do an environmental study. One of the last reports that came out like in early January, the citizens basically said, you know, you need to move us. I mean, this is public housing. What are your thoughts on that?
Now that when there's discussions of the port expanding, this is the time to really make the push for new housing. It's unfortunately not enough action has been taken. There's been a lot of studies. Studies, you know, often provide important information, but at the same time, they're often, I think, used as an excuse to pretend that things are being done. People there are getting sick of studies when they know, and everyone knows, that that's a toxic place to live. About 35% of the residents have asthma. We don't need more studies at this point. We have to move forward with building safe housing.
So the Empire State Plaza had to come up with some backup power. And the folks in Sheridan Hollow, again, for years have suffered under, I guess, the incinerator. So now we've being told that there will be an upcoming demolishing and replacing of the existing dirty power generators. Are there any plans to like rezone that area residential so that no more industrial development can happen down there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure specifically about the zoning. I know that SHARE, the group called SHARE, the Sheridan Hollow Alliance for Renewable Energy, when the state announced that they were going to expand and put a natural gas burning facility there to power the whole plaza, the community organized. People were saying, a lot of environmental groups were saying, why are we investing millions of dollars to expand burning fossil fuels when we're supposed to be transitioning to renewable energy? So everyone kind of got together and fought this together.
With the Dunn landfill, it looks like nothing's going to happen to stop the trucking of the garbage, because again, the DEC has permitted it, so it's okay. And I guess the latest I heard is they're going to build a berm or a large hill to mitigate the dust. Or how do we plan to hold DEC accountable for issuing permits which impact communities?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Time and time and again, they seem to they fail to protect people's health. They issue permits when they shouldn't. They don't take problems like Ezra Prentice seriously enough, or often don't pay attention until there's really enough pressure when they absolutely can't ignore it anymore. You know, I think we have to look at legislation. We got to look at legislation on how we can increase regulations. That's a big piece of it. Increase, you know, a lot of the regulations on what can be, for example, what chemicals can be burned. A lot of the oversight over these polluters. I think we can't trust in the corporations and the that are polluting our environments to regulate themselves. We can't let these industries police themselves. We have to really have strong oversight. We have to expect that if we don't have that oversight, they're going to pollute because they're looking at how they can make the most profits.
So if you're an assemblyman, if you get elected, what kind of legislation do you envision that can be passed to rectify the price of these poor housing or zoning policies?
No, I think maybe an extra like layer before these types of things are approved to really look at the impact on the communities that they're in, and especially something to ensure that low-income communities and the communities of color, communities that are often neglected in these situations, that are often put in the least desirable places to live. So if we could put some extra, you know, layer of protection in there in the permitting process, that I think would be really important. The Dunn landfill's permit is up in 2022. But I really think that there's no reason that permit should be renewed in 2022. That landfill has to close. And I think it's not really getting at the core of the problem, because this landfill is, again, it's run by a company that brings in a lot of money. They're making a lot of money there, and people don't want to address. They want to put the profits of these corporations before the health of people. And ultimately, when there's such a terrible injustice where the kids going to school, the landfill's right next to all the public schools in Rensselaer. When you have a situation like that, I just don't think there's any other option but to close it.
I guess folks need to really pay attention and find the politicians on record who, if they're voting for these and support these facilities, to kind of look for folks who aren't. So what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, my thoughts are, yeah, I think people really have to look at what their current elected officials are doing and look at the history. And, you know, if you look at the person I'm running against, John McDonald, if you look at his record, I think you'll see that he hasn't really been strong on these issues. He hasn't really taken action until there was enough public pressure that he was willing to do, kind of start to speak about it and start to take small actions here and there. But ultimately, we need someone who really understands, is really sides with the people here who are suffering through this, and really understands the core of the problem, and that we are ultimately putting the profits of corporations in letting these polluters do what they want, what they see fit, rather than standing up for the people. And we really have to be looking at all different types of regulations that we can put on them. We have to be pushing for the Dunn landfill to close, not just for a burn. We have to, with Norlite, we have to build new housing as well for the people living at the Saratoga sites, public housing. I don't know how long people knew about the firefighting foam being burned at Norlite, but that should have been addressed a while ago. At the same time, what other chemicals are being burned there? Are we going to find out in 10 years that there are other dangerous chemicals? I think we have to seriously look at, is it safe to burn, to have a hazardous waste burning facility in a residential neighborhood? I don't know if we can safely have that continue to operate in that neighborhood. I think that seriously has to be looked at as well.
And I think, you know, you bring up a good point, because really Norlite's been there a long time. And I think the siting of public housing has always been located in industrial areas. And we're much more aware that happening. So because we're aware, is it time for HUD to come in and say, you know what, these folks should not be here anymore. It's not good for their health and safety. We need to move them.
I know there are talks of that with Saratoga sites in Cohoes, just like there are in South End. But again, it's just talks. I wouldn't trust in HUD right now, Ben Carson. But I think when the federal government fails to take action, that's when the state government has to step in. That's when we have to say, look, we're going to make it happen. And, you know, maybe mm-hmm. We hope we have a new president. Hopefully we'll be able to work with HUD. But we have to take the lead on this, you know, if we can't always rely on the federal government.
Okay, Sam, so we're expecting you to take the lead on this when you get into the assembly.
Look forward to it. I will take the lead. You know, these issues are important, and we need leaders who are going to actually do something that is going to protect people's health. It's at the Port of Albany or next to Norlite. It's environmental racism and environmental classism. And that's why, you know, we often refer to this as environmental justice issues.
So we're going to have to wrap up. Do you have anything else you would like to share with our listeners?
Just to remind everyone that there is a Democratic primary. I'm running in. It's June 23rd. Again, my name is Sam Fine, and you can now vote absentee.
And are there any debates coming up?
There are. There are a couple debates. There's one coming up that's co-hosted by the League of Women Voters and the Council of Albany Neighborhood Associations. And then there is one that is hosted by the NAACP. And the NAACP one is on June 11th. I believe the League of Women Voters and Albany Neighborhood Associations is June 4th, but we'll have to, you know, confirm those dates with people.
Well, thank you, Sam Fine, for your time today, and stay safe.
Thank you, Michelle, and you stay safe as well, and all of our listeners stay safe.
That was Michelle Masurgeon speaking with Sam Fine, candidate for New York State's 108th Assembly District.
And to close out the show, Spencer Keeble speaks with Lex Bagat about the Bucket Garden program at the Albany Free School, which helps South End residents grow produce in their backyards. The pre-filled buckets will be given away on Monday, May 25th from 3 to 6 p.m. at Gabby's Garden, corner at the corner of Grand Street and Wilbur Street, along with Stop the Shooting Barbecue.
Hi, my name is Lex Bagat, and I am a member of the board of the Albany Free School, and I'm also one of the organizers of South End Earth Day.
So the Bucket Garden program, yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The Bucket Garden is usually one of the free school's contributions to South End Earth Day. So South End Earth Day, for anybody who doesn't know, was started by A Village back in 2011 as a community celebration that honors the earth, but also brings volunteers to jumpstart spring by bringing volunteers to different community gardens throughout the South End. And it's like the big spring cleanup when all the gardens get going. So at the free school, we spend a week before Earth Day always with the kids making bucket gardens. The kids work in the greenhouse and produce starts, kale starts, lettuce starts. We get tomato starts from greenhouses. They take city compost and strain it, running it through a strainer, and getting the twigs out and mixing potting soil to put into these 5-gallon buckets that we then give away to neighbors on Earth Day. Because there's a lot of lead in the soil, not everybody can grow food in the ground here in the South End. And so this is what we do. And this year we didn't do it because there was no Earth Day and there is no school. And a couple weeks went by and the director of the school, Deirdre Kelly, she sort of brought the bucket garden component to our Earth Day celebration. She was just like, we have to do it. It's so important. Everybody wants to grow food this year. And like, just because everybody wants to grow food doesn't mean that there's suddenly not lead in their soil or not cement in their backyard. We need to make these buckets like we always do. And so we just kind of got it together to do it with volunteers slowly in our garden. And we're going to be giving buckets away on Memorial Day.
So is there any particular reason that there's lead in the soil of this community of South End?
Well, there's lead in most cities because of lead paint and leaded gasoline. The South End also, the Albany Free School is in the Mansion neighborhood, which is the north part of the South End, adjacent to downtown. And throughout the period of time when the Empire State Plaza was under construction and when garbage laws were a little bit more restrictive or expensive, I guess, to dump, this neighborhood was used a lot for dumping of construction waste. That's a particular reason for here, but throughout all cities, there's a lot of lead in the soil.
Was that dumping taking place before there were people living there? Or?
The Mansion neighborhood is right next to downtown. So there's these arterial roads that go into the Empire State Plaza and the Empire State Plaza itself. So there was massive abandonment in that neighborhood then. And so, you know, in the wake of all that abandonment and empty lots, that's when you have dumping from people who are renovating buildings, dumping from people who were working on the plaza itself. But yeah, the dumping coincides with the whole period of abandonment after the Empire Plaza construction.
You mentioned that the students aren't meeting in person right now. So how are these buckets being made?
Yeah, so usually, you know, we make the buckets with the kids over about 2 weeks. And then we have a day we get them together on Earth Day, and we actually do most of the work on Earth Day itself with the volunteers who come then, which are school parents and SUNY volunteers. And but so this week we're just trying to do it slowly with neighbors. We invited some parents, but you know, we're just getting into phase one of reopening. So, you know, people, you know, there's the only parents who've come are ones who live in the immediate block of school. No one's come from afar, which we appreciate, actually, people not coming into the community from outside. And so it's been really slow. The sifting compost is a wonderful meditative act. And if anybody listening wants to come this week and spend 2 hours or 4 hours with a strainer and sifting compost, we would love your help. And we'll make potting soil. You could take some sifted compost home with you. You could even take some potting soil if you mix potting soil.
So if you're inviting volunteers, so if somebody's interested, how could they volunteer?
Great. There's two ways. We always have volunteer hours at Gabby's Garden. We call the free school garden Gabby's Garden. It's a memorial for a young girl named Gabby. We're always there on Thursdays from 3 to 6 and on Sundays from 9 to 12. We've been there like 9 to 2, actually, the last few weeks. So anybody can drop in then. Gabby's Garden is located at the corner of Grand Street and Wilbur Street. This week, we have a bunch more extra volunteer shifts. We have an ad on Volunteer Match. If anybody's on Volunteer Match, they can search Free School Bucket Garden Project, or you can go to the Free School's Facebook page, facebook.com/AlbanyFreeSchool. And the Volunteer Match page is right there. You can also send us a message through the Free School's Facebook page. So again, that's facebook.com/AlbanyFreeSchool.
So what kind of plantage are you putting in these buckets?
Well, so usually when we do with the kids, we start a lot of lettuce, kale, collards, and we do in the greenhouse. And that's the main thing that we give away. Collards are really popular in the neighborhood. Kale is really easy to grow in the buckets, and lettuce gives you, you know, an immediate satisfaction. Tomatoes are popular, but it's kind of an art to keep them at the right moisture for them to fill the bucket. This year, we're also going to start giving away, we're going to give away a lot more plants because we know that people are just planting more. They're home from work. They're thinking about growing things. Lots of our neighbors are getting small containers to grow on their porches. So we're also filling yogurt buckets, just regular little yogurt buckets with a lot of plants, mostly with kale and some collards. And then we're, we've got a lot of volunteer cosmos flowers. So we're pulling up some cosmos from the garden and putting them in yogurt buckets to give to people to put in their tree pits or in their backyard. Cosmos don't need very good soil, so they're very hardy plants, so we're giving lots of those away too.
Lovely.
And butterflies love them. So
nice. So where do you get the buckets from?
We get buckets from both from three sources. One, there's people who give back the buckets that they've collected in previous years. There's one person who takes 8 buckets for her backyard every year at Earth Day. So we hope we get them back. We don't know if we will. We've one neighbor who has a big garden, and he has decided that it's time for him to cull his massive collection of 5-gallon buckets and give us a bunch this year. And then we get, and Home Depot gives us 25 buckets every year as well.
Is there anything else that you want people to know about the bucket garden program?
No, so we're going to give the plants away on Monday, on Memorial Day, Monday, May 25th from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Stop the Shooting Barbecue. That is put out together by a man named Abdul Noor, who's also known as the mayor of Grand Street. Whenever there's a shooting, he has a Stop the Shooting Barbecue in the neighborhood to ease tensions. So he's working on creating a grab and go version of the Stop the Shooting Barbecue. So if anybody is thinking about doing an event like this in their own neighborhood or how to handle a barbecue, you can check in with us and we'll let you know how the grab and go version works or does not work. because I'm sure that's something people are going to be thinking about doing this summer. And if anybody wants to donate plants, bring them this Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. You can just leave yogurt buckets. You can leave 2-gallon buckets. You can leave them all at Gabby's garden. We will fill them up with plants and give them away on the 25th.
That's great. So can you just repeat where Gabby's garden is located again?
Sure. Gabby's garden is at the corner of Grand Street and Wilbur Street in Albany, New York. If you wanted to put an address in there for your GPS, you could write 97 Grand Street, Albany 12202. If you go up the street to the upper part of the garden, there's a little greenhouse and you can leave the buckets right next to the greenhouse. You can leave plants. There's also a little structure there if you have plants, and if you could leave them in the shade, that's great.
And just one more time, how interested individuals can get in touch with you if they need to.
You can contact the free school. Normally I would say on the phone, but we're not in the building. So the easiest way is to send us a Facebook message. Go to facebook.com/AlbanyFreeSchool. You can find the ad there for our volunteer match page about the Bucket Garden Project. You can also send us a message right there.
Don't forget to show up at the Bucket Garden Program Monday, May 25th from 3 to 5 at Gabby's Garden at the corner of Grand Street and Wilbur Street and participate in the Stop the Shooting Barbecue. Hey, Guy, guess what?
Is it that time again?
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer, and our engineer tonight is Alexis. Remember to tune back in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or want to comment on our work, you can email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio show, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just participate in one of our weekly virtual Zoom meetings Monday nights from 7:07 p.m. by sending an email requesting an invitation to hmm@mediasanctuary.org, hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.